My fellow Australians, for many years, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have advocated for constitutional recognition through a voice. Our government, along with every single state and territory government, has committed to it. Now, my fellow Australians, you can vote for it.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Ballot to Talk About. And what you have just heard is Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese announcing that Australians will go to the polls on the 14th of October to vote on a referendum to enshrine an Indigenous voice in the Constitution. In this week's podcast, we'll be looking ahead to the referendum and asking the big question, can the yes vote win and which states will be pivotal to the outcome? It is Sunday, the 1st of October, 2023.
I pledge to be a president who seeks not to divide, but unify.
Not now. I am a fighter and not a quitter.
Look at Joe Biden.
It's time for a change in this country, my friends. A real change.
And joining me on the other side of the world is my co-host Sam. How's everything going, Sam?
Not too bad, thank you. Autumn has finally arrived, I think, in full force in the UK, so we're starting to change how we're approaching dressing and going outside and everything. But no, everything's well. How about with you?
Well, it's funny you say that, and I did tell this to Sam before we start the recording. But he can just see at the corner of my screen a small fan oscillating in the corner because this week I definitely had to bring it out. And so once again, it's different contrast, isn't it?
Exactly. But what I will tell people listening, because I think it just shows how far the interest in politics goes, is that last night I was out in London and I was texting Churn about the results of the Slovakian parliamentary election at 4 a.m. UK time as I was travelling home from a night out. So if that doesn't say everything about our commitment to politics on this show, I don't know what does.
Apart from that, which I had to actually check, because I was surprised to get a text at that time of the night. 30th of September, Sam, yesterday. Do you know what was the significance of that day? What special event it was to commemorate September the 30th?
I don't know, no.
It is, and I'd like to thank one of the other podcasts that I listened to for telling me this. It is International Podcast Day.
Oh. Well, belated happy International Podcast Day to you.
It really is. And very soon it's going to be this podcast, three years old. So lots of interesting things and lots of interesting to talk about, not only in the future, but also in this week's podcast. And before we talk all things Australia, once again, we're going to go to the other side of the world. And it's fair to say, Sam, we're going to talk about all things Canada. And Canadian politics, Sam, would you not agree, has really not slowed down this summer at all, isn't it?
Not in the slightest. I mean, when we planned to do this podcast, when we were mapping out what our early autumn would look like, the reason we put Canada in here was more about the fact that they're on the verge of a state election in Manitoba in the next few weeks. But also, earlier in the summer, Trudeau did a wide-ranging reshuffle of his cabinet, which we were going to talk about, and talk about the state of Canadian politics, the state of Trudeau's premiership, and unpack the cabinet reshuffle a little bit more in the context of what we were presuming was potentially going to be the beginnings of a ramp up to a snap federal election. Because one thing we do know about Canadian politics in recent years is that minority governments typically last somewhere in the region of 2 to 3 years. And this September, Trudeau's government will be 2 years old. So that's where this came from. But so much has happened in the last few weeks, let alone few months, that I think makes talking about Canada all the more significant and pressing at the moment, because there's a handful of things going on, including a diplomatic incident with India leading to the withdrawal of foreign officials in those countries. And then also just last week, you had the speaker, Anthony Rota, resign following an incident recognizing Yaroslav Honka as a Ukrainian-Canadian war hero. Later revealed that Honka actually was a member of the Waffen-SS in World War II and fought for the Nazis against the Russians. So he became the first speaker since John Bowlesley in 1986 to resign last week. So, Chern, we have cabinet reshuffle to talk about, we've got diplomatic incidents to talk about, we've got speaker resignations to talk about. Where do you want to begin?
And don't forget, there's also been upheaval, which has made news around the world, in Trudeau's personal life as well. His separation from his wife, Sophie Gerard Trudeau. But let's focus on the politics rather than the personal. I think we should definitely start by looking at the reshuffle, because when we were planning this, when I certainly was telling you, Sam, that Trudeau's going to have a reshuffle, I did not expect the scale of this reshuffle to the extent it is. And the statistics are pretty astonishing. So the cabinet is 39 members strong. Only 8 ministers, Sam, kept their jobs in the previous government compared to this new revamped ministry. Although it did include several big names, the Deputy Prime Minister and Finance Minister Kirsten Freeland, the Foreign Minister Melanie Joly, and Industry Minister François-Philippe Champagne, and the Environment Minister Stephen Gilbert. So they've all kept their roles. We saw 7 ministers depart cabinet, 4 of whom announced their retirement from politics at the next election, and 7 new ministers entered the cabinet. I would just like to point out 2 ministers. First is Arif Virani, who probably, I would argue, got, in terms of the headlines, the biggest job promotion, as he's now the new Attorney General and Minister for Justice. And the other is Richie Valdez, who becomes the first Filipina MP has entered the cabinet, and she will be the Minister for Small Business. So that was pretty significant. All the rest of the other ministers, more than half the cabinet, found themselves in new jobs. The headline is that Anita Anand, who when we cover the aftermath of the 2021 election, was moved out of the defense portfolio and replaced by Bill Blair. After a series of scandals, Marco Mendocino, who a lot of the press assumed he'd move to a new job. No, he was sacked from cabinet altogether. He became the Minister for Public Safety. The government's so-called Mr. Fix-It, Dominic LeBlanc, replaced him as Minister for Public Safety, Democratic Institutions, and Intergovernmental Affairs. And full details of all the moves can be found on our Twitter page at @ballot_talk. So Sam, let's digest this reshuffle in a bit more detail. First of all, the scale of this reshuffle. What does it say about Trudeau's government as it now approaches year number 8?
I mean, I think it says that Trudeau felt it necessary to go for a complete reset. I think for a few reasons. One of which is they seem to be at the moment losing the argument on some key policy areas, notably housing and the economy. You said they didn't change their finance minister. Chrystia Freeland has been a long-term key figure in the Trudeau cabinet, is long discussed as a potential successor of his once he does decide to vacate the top of the Liberal politics in Canada. But one of the biggest moves was actually the new Housing, Infrastructure and Communities Minister role, which will be taken up as Sean Fraser, who had previously been voted as the best orator in Parliament, a rising star finalist in the Maclean's Parliamentarian of the Year Awards. Clearly, housing is going to be a huge focus of this new Trudeau revamped cabinet. It's notable that Canadian mortgage-driven debt is actually the highest in the G7. That's frequently pointed out by the Conservatives and is one of the key attack points of the opposition at the moment. So you see a policy shift, I think, in the focus of this government in this new housing role. But I think the other thing that it says, which is just a fact, is that at the moment, Trudeau's party are underwater in opinion polls. The Liberals are losing by in the region of 10 points to the Conservatives in recent opinion polls. And Trudeau's personal approval rating is underwater compared to Pierre Poilievre of the Conservatives. So I think this reshuffle says what is going on in Canada, which is the Liberals need to change their approach if they are going to continue their stint in government. Because certainly, I think if Trudeau were to press the trigger on an early election right now, he'd be almost certain to be out of office. So something needed to change. And I think this reshuffle is demonstration that Trudeau is trying to do that.
Well, I think just a couple of things to add there. On the housing thing, and I think you're absolutely right to talk about Sean Fraser. His was a notable appointment. And it does speak to the fact that I think this government acknowledged that part of the problem with the previous minister, Ahmad Hussein, was communication. I don't think the communication skills of Ahmad Hussein, particularly the Conservatives and Pierre Poilievre, were making a big play on the housing file. They clearly decided that they need a big, better communicator. So Ahmad Hussein was moved out. He became the Minister for International Development. Very much a role that has less communication responsibilities. And you move it into there. And what I think is key as well, Sam, is that he has the full levers of his portfolio. Because not only housing he has a portfolio of, but he also takes over the infrastructure and communities portfolio, which was previously set under Dominic LeBlanc. So I think he also now not only has the oratory skills, but the Trudeau clearly decided was that they need to have the policy levers in place to try and solve the housing crisis, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I mean, at first glance, it's quite a large set of responsibilities for Sean Fraser. But I think one of the key things Trudeau wanted to demonstrate in this reshuffle, not just of personalities, but of machinery of government changes, was that he wants to put in place the best way to actually solve the issues upon which he's being criticised in this moment.
And what I think, Sam, is also interesting is that he's completely changed the law and order team, isn't it? Because you had the Justice Minister, David Lametti, he was one of those who was out of cabinet, and he was not, and similar to the Public Safety Minister, Marco Mendocino, both were ousted, not necessarily because they were going to retire the next election. And Marco Mendocino himself became a problem for the government because Marco Mendocino, there were questions about his handling of the portfolio over the Prime Minister's use of the Emergency Act in response to the Freedom Convoy protest in 2022, over continued allegations swirling around Chinese interference in Canadian federal elections, and finally over the transfer of Paul Bernardo, who was a serial rapist and killer, who was transferred to a medium security facility, which I think caused a lot of alarm bells as well. So I think Trudeau clearly felt that in the law and order space, they needed new faces in those portfolios, because that was clearly, Sam, would you not agree, holding down the government, isn't it? So Sam, who do you think were some of the big winners and losers? We already talked about Marco Mendicino being one of the big losers, but who are some of the others that you have identified that won in this reshuffle?
I've already mentioned him, but I think Sean Fraser is a big winner in this election, because I think you see a clear demonstration from Trudeau in when he was announcing this cabinet and how it's been covered since, is that he's been promoted into a key policy area for the government, and clearly Trudeau intends to use him and that department as one of the key frontline figures of his reshuffle. So I think that is a big winner. I think another low-key big winner, but someone who's not even changed their job in any way, is actually Chrystia Freeland, because she's remained Deputy Prime Minister, remained Finance Minister, and clearly Trudeau still has absolute faith in her to be the frontrunner to inherit the party after he's gone. And I think there could have been a world in which he sees the slump in approval ratings, the slump in party fortunes, as a way to completely reset not just the government, but what the future of the party looks like. And I think his decision not to move some of the big beasts in the party and in the cabinet, I think says a lot about what he thinks the party's fortunes are more generally, rather than the specific policy areas he's grappling with in the moment. Do you agree with that?
I think I largely agree with that he didn't shook it up. And one of the things that interests me was Anita Anand, if you want to talk about leadership contenders, because that was the one that raised the most eyebrows, because she was appointed 2 years ago because there was a culture of, she in specifically with a file to change the culture in the Canadian Armed Forces, in particular how it deals with sexual misconduct allegations. But less than 2 years on, she moves out from the high-profile defence role to become president of the Treasury Board, which in Britain, the equivalent role is chief secretary to the Treasury, essentially. So a move very much that I think will bring her out of the media spotlight. Apparently, she wanted an economic-facing role. But it is interesting to me that it was posted to that role because it's not necessarily as high profile as a defense file that you had. So to me, it's interesting that I think in this reshuffle, her star has been pegged down a little bit, even though I don't think she's really done anything wrong.
Yeah, it is interesting. Speaking of defense, I think Bill Blair is probably a low-key winner in this election. I mean, he's been in Parliament as long as this Liberal government has been in office. He's held a number of portfolios, but defence is by far the largest of them. I think it probably is motivated by his previous career pre-Parliament of being the chief of the police service. But I think that is quite a sizeable promotion for him from his previous role of emergency preparedness.
In fact, there was talk of him going out of cabinet altogether. Far from going out of cabinet, he got a big promotion, in my opinion. And also, big seven of them, obviously any seven that enters cabinet is a big promotion for them. We already talked about the biggest. But I also think, Sam, isn't it really funny? I look at the names of the seven cabinet ministers that have come in. Gary Anasane, who is the Minister for Crown and Indigenous Relations. You got Yara Sachs, who is now the Minister for Mental Health. So you Ryan Martinez-Ferreira, who is a tourism minister. Jenna Suds, who is the Minister for Families, Children, and Social Development, and the first Filipina, as I said. A very different look to this cabinet, isn't it, in terms of ethnicity?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we've talked about previously when we've talked about Trudeau, his government, his cabinet, is that diversity is clearly at the forefront of his mind and the Liberal Party's brand nationally. But you clearly see leaning into that a lot in the way this is reshuffled. And I wonder if part of that is him trying to prepare for whatever this next election looks like. Clearly, he thinks that this is a key contingent for him, I think, and he wants the cabinet to look more like Canada as a whole and more like his party and the pockets of the country that his party represents. And I wonder if, do you get the sense that this is going to be the election cabinet, or do you think there's still more to come?
I think as much this is the cabinet he will want to take to the next election. It's also interesting to me, when we talk about the next election, look at all these constituencies in which the ridings they represent. Burnaby North, which is the new Citizen Services Minister, Terry Beach's riding. Richie Valdez, Mississauga, Streetsfield. These are all battleground districts, that ridings that they hold as well. So you move from ministers, like, look at Monia Fortier, who was the president of the Treasury Board before. She represented the seat of Ottawa Vanier, the safest Ottawa seat in the region. She's replaced as the Ottawa cabinet minister now is Jenna Suds, the children's minister, the most marginal of the Ottawa region's current MPs, Liberal MPs. So I also think as well is that it's an election cabinet because you're also promoting, in terms of coverage, the people who stand to benefit most from an increased profile as well. Obviously, there is a trade-off because now that you're a cabinet minister, you have to run a government. You cannot do the same now groundwork you could do as you are a backbencher or parliamentary secretary. So there is a trade-off there. But I think in Trudeau's calculations, the profile that comes with being a cabinet minister and the prestige outweighs the potential for, let's say, less door-knocking opportunities as a backbencher.
Mm-hmm. I mean, before we start talking about the recent incidents since we decided to talk about the reshuffle, I just had one more question that broadens it out a bit, which is that we've mentioned a few times already that the Conservatives are currently polling in a position that would almost guarantee them control of the government in either a minority or majority setting, which is very different from the position the Conservatives were in the last election, where Trudeau almost won a surprise third term to a certain extent. So what has changed, and why have the Liberal fortunes collapsed so significantly?
And it's also been slightly surprising, isn't it, Sam? Because it's also over the summer as well. I think in some ways, you know, people often ask me, like, what is the impact of a reshuffle on the government's fortunes? And my answer is usually no impact whatsoever. But I wonder if this tacit administration, or certainly the media coverage of it, is that, you know, we know things have gone wrong, have just further reinforced the fact that this government is panicking a little bit and is 8 years old. I think a lot of the reasons why the Liberals fell in the polls was the fact that it is an eight-year-old government. It is an eight-year-old government that's been through COVID. And we know and that COVID has often accelerated the ages of many governments. So I think that its time factor for a change is really coming up on the Trudeau administration as well. I definitely think the Conservatives also with Pierre Poilievre had a very good message on housing and cost of living that he's able to convert into sound bites pretty effectively as well. And therefore, people are giving him a bigger look as well. So I think a combination of factors ranging from the government's communication skills and the government's age is causing them to lose a lot of support over the last couple of months. What do you think, Sam?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think age plays a big role here. And similar to when we were talking last week, when we were talking about New Zealand and Chris Hipkins heading into this election, obviously they're in a different, very different place in the electoral cycle because Trudeau is at best 2 years away from an election, unless something significant happens or he decides to go early, and Chris Hipkins is 2 weeks away from an election. But I think the story about the parties is similar in that they've both been through COVID, they've both been through tough economic times. I mean, we talk about the economy being fundamental and those fundamental indicators about the country's fortunes matter a lot to parties and their fortunes. And the economic situation in Canada is about as great as it is in most other countries at the moment, which is that they're heading into a technical recession, interest rates are high and stagnant, and core inflation is stagnant at about 4%. So they're not great economic indicators for any government, and any government, I think, would be struggling to regain a narrative in an environment where the economic indicators are not great.
And that's why you see the fact that although they kept the main, if you look at the economic team in this cabinet, you could argue that some of the bigger beasts within this Liberal cabinet have been moving to economic portfolios because that's where the government feels the Conservatives have been gaining traction. We talked about Anita Anand, for example, Richie Valdez, a small business minister, adding another person to the team. Small business was previously part of Mary Ng's portfolio, but she retains economic development and trade. She loses small business. So you get another voice around the cabinet table speaking on economic issues as well. Jean-Valles Duclos, for example, he's a trained economist and he's the Minister for Public Services and Procurement, which whilst it's I think it's demotion, it's also the fact that it is a more economic facing portfolio than it was the health. So I definitely think that there has been attempts to bolster the economic team in response to what you just said, Sam.
So just to wrap up our discussion on Canada, Shem, we've alluded to a couple of incidents that have happened in the last few weeks in Canada with the diplomatic incident with India and also the resignation of the Speaker. Do you think these have any impact on the fortunes of the Liberals, or are they quite unique incidents?
Well, let's deal with them individually. Let's talk about the Speaker first. Now, I think, Sam, you and I, we know that the Speaker is thoroughly independent, you know, in terms of its role and functions from the government. But I wonder to the average voter whether they're able to divorce that separation between what the Speaker does and what the government does. Because if the answer to that question is no, I think this scandal has potential to hurt. But if the answer is yes, I think that the government will be okay. It did strike me that the reason Anthony Rota resigned is because prominent Liberals started speaking out. Because I think from their calculation, even though the Speaker is technically independent of the government, it did not have to go through global affairs vetting of the same extent of vetting in terms of protocol as a normal state visit would ordinarily entail. I think the government's calculations that people could not tell the difference, and therefore Anthony Rota had to go no matter what. But I still think that the bigger cause for... the interesting thing to me is, how would the impact of Canada's now frosty and deteriorating relationship with India play out? Because I could see the issue cutting both ways. Because amongst the Indian Hindu diaspora, Modi is, of course, very popular. And we saw the impact of the Chinese diaspora, because in 2021, the Conservatives had a very hardline approach to China, and that cost the Conservatives in a couple of seats where there's a high Chinese population. I see potentially that in seats with a high Hindu population, that the Liberals could potentially suffer. On the other hand, the citizen who the Indian government was accused of assassinating on Canadian soil, he was a Sikh nationalist. And Canada has one of the highest proportion of Sikh nationalist diaspora in the world. So therefore, that could burnish the Liberal government's credentials. So one effect could simply knock out the other. What do you think, Sam, of my analysis?
Yeah, I agree with you on both points. I think the speaker incident is the less significant of the two for the government, because I think Trudeau has made a big effort in the last week to sort of pin the entire responsibility of the Yaroslav Hunka incident on Anthony Rota rather than on the government, and say that actually the government wasn't privy to the invite list, and actually Hunka was added to the list specifically by Rota himself. So I think it's been much easier for the government to distance themselves from that incident. And I think it's one of those things that may well just wash away with the tide of politics and not linger on. The India incident, however, I think is more significant because, one, it's not abating, and two, it goes to Trudeau himself, and that is the person at the centre of this incident in the media and I think in the public consciousness as well. I think your point about the Sikh population is really significant because of the Indo-Canadian population, according to recent census data, the highest proportion of Indo-Canadians are Sikhs, around a third of them, just over a third. So I think that is a much higher proportion of potential voters who potentially sympathise with Trudeau's position on this if it ends up becoming factual, or the investigation rumbles on and finds some element of truth in this. Now, it's worth saying, I think, for our listeners, that it is unclear at the moment exactly what is true. India clearly are denying this. Other countries around the world just want an open investigation, and Canada and different Canadian parties take a very different approach on this as well. This is very much Trudeau's position and the position of the government. But I think it'll be interesting because at the moment in Canada, most of politics is focused on domestic policy weaknesses, and this is very much a foreign policy issue. But I think it is one of those things that if it stays at the centre of news coverage for a few more weeks, it could start taking over the narrative from some of those domestic indicators. I think the glimmer of hope for Trudeau is that in a general election, domestic politics pretty much always trumps foreign politics. So potentially by the time we get there, it won't be at the top of discussion at all, as much as other politicians might attempt to put it there.
Well, I think that what it has done is that the government is talking about things that it probably didn't want to talk about, isn't it? Because the Canadian government recently just had, a week or so ago, it opened the fall session of its parliament, and everyone was talking about how, and the Liberals suddenly gearing up to talking about housing and making a lot of announcements around cost of living and that domestic economic focus. Well, what it's had to do in the last week or so is that to do with foreign policy matters, the breakdown of India's relationship with India, Canada's relationship with India, and it's also had to deal with allegations of anti-Semitism, you know, and all those things like that. So I think it has suddenly distracted the government from what is a very crucial fall session, and I don't think that is good. But there is still time, and elections only due to take place in 2025. Ordinarily, I suspect we'll be talking about election now, but this is essentially an election cabinet. in a sense that if an election was held by now, this is the amount of change we ordinarily get. So maybe we're having the election reshuffle, but just not the election itself. And speaking of that election, Sam, when do you expect that election to be?
I think that's a very tough question. I mean, we've seen, as we talked about in recent years, the sort of average length of minority governments is 2 to 3 years. In fact, the last minority government to last more than 3 years was in the 1920s. So we're talking 100 years ago. So if I were a betting man, I'd probably put my bets on an election being maybe in the back end of next year, next September potentially. But I don't see any incentive for going for that, if anything, if things stay the same, because unlike the last minority government Trudeau held, the last one that he took into the election, this one actually has a more formal confidence and supply arrangement with the NDP. So I think has an element of longevity that the previous one didn't. So could we be seeing a 100-year trend bucked this time? Given the opinion polls, I would probably side with yes. But if it was going to be snap, I think we're looking at next September.
I think so too. Next September, not this year, potentially next September. And the only reason why I would say next September, I largely agree with you. I think he will need every amount of time he has available to close that gap, that 10-point gap in the opinion polls. It's half the gap that Rishi Sunak has had to do, and is already struggling to close that. So I think Trudeau is going to struggle a bit to try and close that gap itself. The only one reason why I say a snap election next year is the possible. I saw a recent opinion poll, Sam. Guess amongst NDP voters, how the proportion of NDP voters poll who won the confidence and supply deal with the Liberals to be pulled is 40%. Nearly half of the party's voters. I do not think that is a very good sign. So I would think he would like to go as far as possible, but that could be one spanner in the works to keep out for, isn't it?
So we'll be moving on now to talk about the other half of this week's content, which is about the Indigenous Voice referendum that will be taking place on the 14th of October to potentially have a constitutional amendment that will enshrine the Indigenous voice to Parliament as recommended by the Uluru Statement of the Heart of 2017. Chern, in a second, I'm going to ask you to sort of set out what is being voted on and how this referendum came about, because I think for listeners outside of Australia, it may not be in their consciousness at the moment. But what I will set out beforehand is just set out how referendums work in Australia, because for a referendum to pass, you not only need a majority of voters across the country, but you crucially need a majority of states as well. You need that double majority. So that's 4 of the 6 states in Australia. And note that that does not include the Australian Capital Territory or the Northern Territory, which means you need a majority in 4 out of 6 of Tasmania, Western Australia, South Australia, New South Wales, Queensland, and Victoria. The referendum at its heart seeks to achieve 2 aims. 1, to recognise Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander as the first Australian in the preamble to the Constitution. And 2, to establish an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice to Parliament who can make representations to both the Federal Parliament and the Executive Government. Chern, talk us through what is being voted on and how did we get here?
Okay, so this referendum is number 45, compared to 44 previous referendums. Before I talk a bit more about the Indigenous voice to Parliament, 44 referendums, Sam, how many have met the double majority? How many, i.e. how many referendums have passed?
If my calculations were correct, I think 8 of them have passed.
Correct. And the last one to pass was in 1977. So it's been a while since a referendum has passed. So I think the funny thing is that I suspect at the start of this process, a lot of people were dusting out the old constitution to find out what it meant. Because for a lot of people, they've not had... The last referendum was in 1999 on the monarchy. So it's been a while. A whole generation of voters have not had the chance to vote in the referendum. Now, The indigenous voice to parliament came out as what you said was the Uluru Statement from the Heart. And the Uluru Statement from the Heart was basically a petition that was written and endorsed by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander leaders who gathered for First Nations National Constitutional Convention. It is a one-page document that was passed on the 26th of May 2017 over 4 days near Uluru in Central Australia. And basically, the convention was held after a 16-member referendum council, which was appointed by both Malcolm Turnbull and Bill Shorten, who was the prime minister and opposition leader at the time, had traveled around the country, met with over 1,200 people to come. They all sent proposals for how you could advance Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. And that was why it was set up originally. And they gathered Uluru and they came out the Uluru Statement from the Heart. And that is how, from that, it was debated in cabinet twice under the coalition government, but it never got anywhere under them. But when Anthony Albanese came to power, in the victory speech on the night he won the election, he identified that Labour implement the Uluru Statement from the Heart in full. And part of it is recognizing Indigenous and Torres Strait Islander people in the preamble to the Constitution as the first peoples within Australia. So that's how it came about. Sam, did I miss anything?
No, I think you've summed it up perfectly there, which is how we ended up getting here. And I think the crucial point to have made that you said before we start to unpack how this referendum has unfolded and looks to unfold for the last 2 weeks of it is that the original referendum council and the Uluru Statement from the Heart was conceived in part by both the coalition and the Labour Party. And that's I think that's crucial as we head into discussing this referendum, which is that this was a cross-party mission to try and expand First Nations rights and First Nations political engagement in the country. And I think that's a crucial first step when you begin to understand how this referendum has gone on. And I think the other part of the story that you did reference, but I think is important again to set out, is that the coalition government, the Turnbull government, Malcolm Turnbull himself actually is in favour of this referendum and is on the yes side of the referendum itself. But his government rejected the concept of the Uluru Statement from the Heart. And the Morrison government later pledged to implement the recommendations, but at no point in the government did they proceed with any legislation to do that. So it wasn't until we got to this Labour government that this referendum was taking place, and Albanese, as you said, had promised to hold this referendum in his first term of government. So that's how we got here, and that's what is being voted on in Australia in 2 weeks' time. But Chern, I think it's safe to say that this relatively straightforward idea, I would suggest, and most politicians seem to agree in principle with what was recommended by the Uluru Statement from the Heart, has turned into a pretty divisive and contentious referendum, hasn't it?
It really has. But one thing I would like to state forward is that, did you know, Sam, in 1999, when Australians voted in the referendum to establish a republic, they also voted in a second referendum question. Do you know what that was?
I don't know.
It was to alter the constitution to insert a preamble which honours Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders as the nation's first people for their deep kinship with their lands and for their ancient and continuing cultures which enrich the life of the country. Also recognise immigrants mindful of responsibility to the natural environment. So actually, in effect, part of this referendum is the second attempt at trying to insert that preamble recognising Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders into the preamble to the constitution. For listeners who are curious, in 1999, that went down by 61% to 39%, and there was a no vote in all states and territories apart from the ACT. So I think they're definitely hoping to do one better than that. Mm. But to go back to your wider point, yes, it has been very divisive. And I think a big reason, Sam, and you cannot go past this, is that the Liberal Party decided to oppose this referendum, hasn't it?
Yes, and I think that's where we should begin, which is, where everybody stands in this referendum. I mean, on the surface, the government is on the yes side, and the opposition, federally, is on the no side. But it's not necessarily...
It's a caveat, largely on the no side.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. What I was about to say is that we should say, though, there are key national figures in the Liberal Party who are campaigning for yes. Two people, actually. One resigned from the party in full to campaign for the yes campaign, and one resigned from the shadow cabinet. The Attorney General resigned from the shadow cabinet to campaign for the yes campaign. And much further down on the state level, there are state Liberal parties who are campaigning on the yes side, and a majority of state Liberal parties, in fact, haven't taken a position on the referendum. But crucially, Peter Dutton and the shadow cabinet has, and the position that they've adopted is to campaign on the no side. And that has what has defined this referendum and has made it much more polarised, I think, than Anthony Albanese ever envisaged it becoming.
I think so too. And what is interesting, the Liberal position, actually, when talk about positions, is that they, if the question was just about inserting and recognizing Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders in the preamble to the Constitution, the Liberals have said that they were campaigning with the government for a yes vote. They are against the concept of the voice and enshrining it in the Constitution. Now, I think they're coming from a variety of different ways. There are definitely some constitutional conservatives who are worried about enshrining in the founding document. I think that's where some of it is concerning them. But also some of them is coming from a more small government point of view, more bureaucracy. So I think there's a whole different myriad of views driving the Liberals' no vote. And I think it should be acknowledged. And you talk about the different state parties. The New South Wales division, the leader is voting yes, by the way, even though the party has an open question. I think it's an open question in the Victorian branch, but I think the leader is voting no. And in Queensland, where I'm currently recording this podcast, the LNP is a no. So you're right, the Liberal Party statewide in all the different state branches have different views and taken different positions. But I should also say, Sam, it's not only the Liberals that have experienced slight division, the Greens have as well. Because often seen as one of the most prominent of the Greens Aboriginal senators, Lydia Thorpe, resigned from the Greens and is now an independent senator, because in her view, and the Greens are supporting the voice, in her view, it should be a treaty first between the Australian government and its First Peoples rather than a voice. So that's the progressive side of why there is a no vote as well. And I think, Sam, would you not agree with me, you have a conservative case to vote no and a progressive side to vote no. That is making this winning this referendum even harder as well, isn't it?
Yes, and let's move on to where the fortunes of this referendum, because for much of the build-up to the referendum, certainly for the first year of the Albanese government, the yes side was holding a pretty commanding lead, both overall nationally, but also it was leading in about 5 of the 6 states across the country. Even in Queensland at one point it was holding a yes lead, and that's seen as one of the least likely places to support this referendum in 2 weeks' time. So how did we have that commanding yes lead? And two, what has happened since to make it dissipate so much that it's not even now seen as a neck-and-neck referendum in the polls? It's seen as an almost certain no victory, if opinion polls are accurate and to be believed.
Well, I think we can definitely spend a podcast talking about what happened to the Yes campaign, because I think it's also interesting for a variety of reasons. Now, the No campaign here in Australia, they had a very simple slogan: if you don't know, vote no. And I think it's very simple for people to understand. And the government the Labour government made a very strategic decision, because it decided not to give any detail at all about how the voice itself will be implemented, what its roles and powers are, how it will be elected. They said they will review all that detail after a successful referendum has passed. And the reason why they said that was because I think Anthony Albanese was trying to ensure that a repeat of the 1999 Republic referendum was not repeated. And in that referendum, why the Republic question went down was because there were disagreements over the model you will elect a new head of state. I think Anthony Albanese decided now that he would not release too much information because he didn't want to be bogged down in detail, which will bog down the yes case. But I think the no case has had a very simple message and that has cut through. The other thing to mention as well is that the no campaign has only had two spokespeople. You had the shadow Indigenous minister, Jacinta Nambajimba Price, who is an Indigenous woman itself, who replaced Julian Lisa, who was a shadow attorney general and shadow minister for Indigenous Australians. He resigned from the shadow cabinet because he's a very strong supporter of The Voice and he's campaigning for a yes vote. And Warren Mundine, who is a former Labour Party president, but now is in the Liberal Party. I think that's very clever, putting up an Indigenous man and an Indigenous woman as your chief spokespeople. It was so that you have a clear message articulated by two Indigenous people to show that even Indigenous people themselves are divided on this issue. And in contrast to the yes case, I read somewhere that the yes spokespeople have had 32 people being spokespersons over the last couple of months. So their messages were all filtered throughout and they had no consistent message. So I think they've suffered from that. And thirdly, I think as well is you cannot ignore the fact that Australia, like in many other countries, there is a cost of living crisis going on. There is a view out there in the community that The Voice itself, or certainly a lot of talk and a lot of political capital spent on The Voice by the government, has distracted the government from core economic fundamentals and dealing with the cost of living. And so therefore, I think part of the reason why there is a no vote is because it's sending a signal that the community is hurting and they want the government's 100% focus on the economy and jobs. The government is arguing that it can walk and chew gum at the same time, but I don't think that that argument has cut through.
Yeah, I think all of that was a nice summary of one of the reasons the No campaign has taken the lead in this. I think the other thing to play into, not just about the misunderstanding of what The Voice necessarily is and how it will function, and as you said, it was a deliberate ploy by the government to not set out the details to try and avoid them getting bogged down in them, but I think that has left open wide ranges of interpretations of how The Voice will be conducted and has led to the spread of quite a significant amount of misinformation on both sides, but particularly from the regressive No side. I mean, there have been some claims that non-Indigenous people will be banned from attending major sporting events. There's been claims that there was a voice referendum held in the past which failed. There have been AI-manipulated videos of Albanese and Thomas Mayo. There have been claims that I saw in a Guardian Essentials survey, they asked people why they were voting No. And one of the most frequently given responses was that people said they will, if they vote yes and The Voice is established, they'll need to start to pay to go to federal parks and beaches, was one of the most frequently given responses. So the level of misinformation because of this void created by Albanese not setting out what The Voice will look like is becoming a huge issue in this referendum campaign and has basically led any side to give whatever interpretation they want of what The Voice will become, how much power it will have, and what impact it will have on federal government operations. So I think money is hugely significant. I think the financial situation in Australia, given that there is $75.2 million so far assigned in the budget for the referendum, with more money set aside should the referendum require it. And I think the different strengths of the relative campaigns have been important, but I think at the heart of it, I think the misinformation has been much more powerful from the No side in convincing people with a Project Fear element that yes is something to be concerned about.
I agree with you. You want to talk about other conspiracy theories. There were others about the length of the Uluru statement, whether there was a conspiracy theory on the internet in some parts that it was a 26-page document rather than a one-page. And the assertion is that there's a whole other bit that's due to come out that could be potentially that we don't know about. And it's all feeding into the central No case. If you don't know, vote no. Now, there were 26 pages of submissions, but the final document itself is only one page long. But
I think one other thing going on here is that much more powerful in referendums around the world, in many cases, is the status quo, because it's not unknown. So as you said, the slogan being, if you don't know, vote no, I think has been very powerful. And I read an article where someone was talking about how, look at other referendums around the world that have passed recently. So a lot of them are about marriage equality, as one example. They were explaining that they think marriage equality and love is something that that most people can engage with and understand. But the plight of Indigenous recognition in the Australian Constitution is not necessarily something that most Australians can empathise with, because they just don't have that lived experience. Whereas people who have been married in traditional male-female marriages can understand love, marriage, the commitment and what it means, and therefore can empathise with the same-sex couples' campaigns for marriage equality. Whereas when you're talking about the Indigenous voice or Indigenous rights, I think it's much more difficult for the wider Australian public to empathise with those issues in the same way. So the status quo message is much more appealing to them than change, which they don't know the finer details of.
And I think as well, I think as well, is that because we've not had referendums in such a long period of time, people have been looking back into the closet and working out what worked then and what didn't work then, and whether we can transplant it to this referendum. So I definitely think the Yes campaign, we talked about learning, taking some lessons from the 1999 Republican referendum. I think from the 2017 referendum, the other thing that they keep talking about for a while is a grassroots campaign. And that was very much the Yes case as well in that case. It was a grassroots campaign, people knocking on doors to spread the message on gay marriage, and to persuade people to vote yes. The Yes campaign for the Indigenous voices used exactly the same thing. But I think in this, you can't really compare the two, because even when you did compare that, you in 2017 in the marriage law, what we did see there was both the Prime Minister at the time, Malcolm Turnbull, and the opposition leader, Bill Shorten, both supported the referendum. The Liberal Party was then more evenly split on the gay marriage vote than it is on this Indigenous voice referendum. And I don't think that that could be ignored either. So, and I just think that they just left it too late, because yes, you want to persuade people in the last 2 or 3 weeks are crucial, the final run in. But I just think that it's too late to arrest this decline that you've just been seeing build up over the last couple of months. And even the sprint that all the campaigns are, I can definitely tell you that if you watch television right now, particularly on the Yes case, the number of Yes ads there are, I think it's just too late now to change people's views, if they are at all aware of this referendum.
I mean, Chad, I'm just going to pick up on something you said about the party political divide being key in this election, and how the Liberal side, on the whole, is much more united on the no than it was in the marriage equality vote in 2017. But do you not find that interesting? Because Peter Dutton and the coalition are persistently underwater compared to Albanese and the Labour Party. The Labour Party is polling ahead. Anthony Albanese is consistently more popular than Peter Dutton on the federal stage. And yet it's the Liberal side, quote-unquote, of this referendum which are winning. So how are people managing to make that distinction with, I don't like the person and I don't like the party and I don't like their other policies, but I'm willing to listen to them on this?
Let me ask you this question, Sam. Since World War II, how many one-term governments have there been in Australia?
None.
Yes. I think people are willing to give Albanese the benefit of the doubt. They know that, and they hope by the 14th and 15th of October that this will have been behind them. I think there is, people still believe the Liberals deserve more than the one term out of the wilderness that they've had, or 1 year out of the wilderness so far. Albanese has been damaged in the opinion polls. He has, his approval ratings have come down. His lead as preferred prime minister has come down. I think Labour's honeymoon period, compared to a couple of months ago, has gone down. But I think people are wanting to send the government a message they're not happy, but they're not necessarily yet willing to part their vote. That's how I would describe the views of the Australian people at the moment.
No, that's interesting. As I said, it just struck me as fascinating that Peter Dutton, who is a notoriously unpopular figure at the moment in Australian politics, is effectively fronting a campaign that is going, that looks at the moment to be on track to be hugely successful against a relatively popular government, which I just think is an interesting political feature. But I totally understand what you were just explaining about Australian politics more widely. And I think it's also much easier for him to represent a single issue campaign and not be underwater on a single issue compared to when you're looking at the package of the Liberal National Coalition as a whole, as you would in a federal election.
I think two things to add as well is that Peter Dutton has not been the face of this referendum. Yes, he's been one of the most prominent voices because he's leader of the opposition. But as I said earlier, the two no spokespeople are Warren Mundine and Jacinta Namba-Jimba Price. So I think that's part of the reason why that lift in the coalition's numbers is not necessarily translated into an election winning lead as well. And the other thing as well is that Peter Dutton himself knows that winning this referendum is only step one of the Liberals regaining power. It is not that it is only, it's one step on a very long road to get there. And I think he knows that as well. And that is within the wider context, as you said, of the fact that he also knows it's a single issue. When it comes down, as we said, all politics does, and particularly now with the 24-hour news cycle, as between Anthony Albanese or Peter Dutton, he has still a lot of work to do that, but he's definitely trying to tarnish that. And I cannot help but think that one reason why the Liberals voted no, apart from the constitutional conservative argument over the government argument, over the size and role of government, is the fact that they know that Albanese will be damaged from this, and that will politically help the Liberals. Just simple as that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. And the political damage maybe is one of the motivations why the Federal Liberal Party as a whole chose to come down on that no side so starkly, despite some figures in the Liberal Party clearly lower down in the state ranks thinking very differently about this issue. And I do find it interesting that when questioned about it, you do see that federal Liberal figures, rather than criticising the voice as a concept, because they seem to sort of accept the idea in principle of the statement of heart and the voice, it's very much about the execution, the finances and the unknown, which I think is interesting in itself. One thing I was going to say, Chern, is I can't help but make what is really a cheap comparison, really, with the Brexit referendum in the UK. Obviously, it's very different in terms of what it wants to achieve. It's also very different in that the EU referendum was support, the Remain campaign was supported by both the Prime Minister and Leader of the Opposition. But the Conservatives did give their members a free vote. But where I think the comparison is more compelling is in the campaigns, because the Remain campaign in the UK, a bit like the Yes campaign in Australia, was made up of a plethora of figures, a plethora of campaign points, a plethora of arguments in favour of that side. And then on the No and Leave campaigns, you have a much more focused campaign. You have sort of two distinct camps. I mean, Australia, you've got the establishment camp led by the Liberal Party federally and the two figures they're putting up. But then in the background, you've got the Pauline Hanson One Nation approach to this referendum, which is stirring up the more dangerous, racially motivated aspects of the campaign, in the same way that on the Leave campaign, you sort of had the headline Leave campaign led by Boris Johnson, Gisela Stewart and Michael Gove. But then in the backgrounds, you had the sort of Aaron Banks, Nigel Farage, Libertarian, UKIP aspect of the campaign, where they're doing the heavy lifting that the mainstream don't want to do or don't want to engage with. And I think there is an interesting comparison being made there about which campaign was able to win, the one that's focused and has two wings doing two distinctly different jobs, or the one that's trying to make an argument from a whole different range of perspectives, but in doing so loses focus. And I think that is an interesting comparison.
I totally agree with you. And one more point to add as well, is you talked about the three figures in the Leave campaign, Michael Gove, Boris Johnson and Gisela Stewart. Michael Gove and Boris Johnson, of course, from the Conservative Party, Gisela Stewart, former Labour MP. So you got the Conservative side to vote no, and you got the Progressive side to vote no. Similar in Australia as well. Yeah, Lydia Thorpe leading the Progressive case to vote no, and the largely Conservative side to vote no as well. So yes, there are very similar parallels as well. Disinformation as well. The parallels of the campaign, I think you very summed it up very nicely about the different slogans, that they cut through the different slogans. There are definitely some parallels to be drawn there, for sure, that can explain. And it's 2 weeks to go, and we'll find out certainly within the next 2 weeks itself. And I think that leaves us to, on our concluding remarks, where essentially, Sam, this is not really a referendum because you need a double majority. Essentially, because you need a majority of the states, it's a first-past-the-post election, isn't it? You need a majority of voters in a majority of states. So the key states are South Australia, Tasmania. It is widely expected, because you only need, you need majority, four out of the six. If you have at least two states that vote no, three states that vote no, it's game over. It's largely expected that Queensland and Western Australia are going to vote no. So therefore, this referendum, if the first part passes, i.e. there's an overall yes vote, it will come down to South Australia and Tasmania. Sam, within this context of the challenge over the next 2 weeks, it's interesting that TV ads, by the way, is the highest per capita in South Australia. Do you think this referendum's already lost for the yes campaign?
I think it would be a phenomenal mountain to climb in the last few weeks if the yes campaign were going to win, unless the opinion polls are wildly inaccurate. I mean, we've seen in recent years in Australia that opinion polls have been relatively accurate across the board, both on state and federal level. So it would be unusual if the opinion polls were this wrong, and the yes campaign were to go on to win. So I think for that reason, I think it is going to be very, very difficult for the Yes campaign to turn this around, particularly because you have to get four states on side. I think Victoria is pretty much in the bag at this stage for the Yes campaign. I think Tasmania is looking pretty much in the bag as well. And really, it's your, it's South Australia and New South Wales that are on a knife edge. But to describe South Australia as on a knife edge, I think is misinterpreting the data, because the most recent poll conducted last week had no on 48%, yes on 36%, and don't know on 16%. So if you exclude don't knows, that's a 12-point lead for the no side. There's going to have to be some significant change in South Australia. Money's being poured in, by far, as you said, highest TV spending. Equally, it's the highest social media ad spending as well in South Australia and Tasmania, interestingly. But I think it's a huge mountain to climb to overturn a campaign that like the No campaign, which clearly has momentum on its side. And if anything, you might see the No lead grow in the next few weeks, rather than it begin to shrink.
I think I largely agree with you like that as well. And I think as well, you talk about messaging, we talk about the No campaign. I think Peter Dutton's been quite clever in his messaging as well, because he's framed Anthony Albanese, this is the Canberra voice, rather than the Indigenous voice. So he's attached the whole stigma of government and the federal government as the Canberra voice. And I think that's really trying to rile up the Conservative base there. He does have a proposal for local and regional voices that he has proposed. But I also think, even talk about messages, it just occurred to me that message has also come through. And I think that has had some impact as well. On the Tasmania point, I think Tasmania is largely a large unknown, because in a lot of these samples, the sample for Tasmania is very small. I think it's like 50 votes. So the margin of error is very high. So I think Tasmania could be a yes, but the uncertainty of a small sample size cannot be ignored.
And it's the hardest state to poll that historically as well. Mm.
Precisely. So, but I largely agree with you. I think it'd be a large uphill battle, and the focus really, a lot, even the government's focus, particularly the news coverage in the last couple of days, is that the government is thinking, what happens if there is a no vote, and is gearing up for that. I think it's reading where the TDs are blowing in this one, Sam.
Well, Chen, it won't be long before we know the results.
No, it would not be. And that, Sam, is another election that's due to take place on the 14th of October, joining an illustrious list of New Zealand, Poland, the voice referendum, and the second round of the Ecuadorian presidential election. So it's going to be a very, very busy weekend for this podcast. But for now, that is it for the latest episode of Ballot to Talk About. Do join us again in 2 weeks' time. We'll not be putting an episode next week, when we'll be breaking down the results from yesterday's Slovakian parliamentary election and the state election in Manitoba, Canada. And as always, we'll continue to bring you up to date on the world of politics and elections from around the world. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at @ballot_talk. And please do leave us a rating or review, or simply tell your friends about us. You can also email any feedback or comments to ballot2talkabout@gmail.com. My name is Chen Han, and until next time, we will speak to you soon.